And tonight I get the pleasure to introduce Meredith. And if you don't know Meredith, you are missing out. She is an amazing woman, and I love her story, and I am friends with a lot of her sponsees or pigeons. I give you Meredith.
Thank you, Kat. Thank you for coming out.
Thank you to the Tim who can't be here, and to Tim and to Kat for hosting. It's a privilege to be asked to do anything Alcoholics Anonymous, and to hear people talk about the way I am today. Sometimes I just can't wrap my mind around it. And it's all because of Alcoholics Anonymous and what this program has done for my life. So my name is Meredith. I'm an alcoholic. Amen. My sobriety date is May 30th, 1998. You don't need to do the math. It'll be 28 in May. I'm really looking forward to 29 if I live that long, because then I will have been sober longer than I drank. Right now it's a tie. Okay? And I want to beat the tie. I didn't know I was restless, irritable, and discontented as a kid. I was introduced to alcohol at a very young age. We socially drank at my home, and at the holidays it was champagne. And I remember when I was 10 years old, my grandmother on my father's side, who was deathly temperate, said, oh, what could a little champagne hurt the kids? You know, they have such pretty glasses. And so we each got these like 1 ounce glasses of champagne. And luckily for me, I drank mine. My brother Jeffrey didn't like his. My brother Andrew didn't like his. I mean, Matthew and then Jackie didn't like hers. So I got 4 ounces of champagne at 10 years old, and bazing, man. I loved that warmth that went down my throat. I loved how it made me feel. I got all warm in my head. I got all tingly. I just loved it. And it definitely produced a certain amount of personality change, because now I'm doing, you know, somersaults and cartwheels, and I got my pretty dress on, and I don't care that my crinoline is showing. And I'm playing piano, and I always hated playing piano for people. And then I needed a nap. And when I woke up, I had a terrible, terrible headache. And the first thing that came to mind was, I can't wait till Christmas. We drink champagne at Christmas, too. And so when they talked to me, and when I started reading this book, okay, so 31 years later, I realized, oh my gosh, I do have this allergy of the body. I do have this obsession of the mind, because it rooted with the first drink. See, we're taught, you know, a lot of these puzzles that we do, that it's the obsession and the allergy. But the allergy is what comes first. I've got to drink it and experience it. And boy, did I. And I remember thinking, this stuff is great. And our living room looked like, we grew up in the suburbs of New York, and our living room looked like something out of Mad Men. Big fancy, you know, big fancy living room for parties. We added the room on. It was so important to my family. And we had a standing bar, and ho, 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 and cigarette smoke. And I remember being one of five kids up the stairs in the children's area, and it was so boring up there. I wanted to be down there, and I was, you know, under 10 years old. And I wanted to be at the party, man. And I remember when those parties were over, I'd go around and eat the cherries out of those drinks. Man, those are my kind of cherries. And so I loved it from the beginning. And Grandma, my mother's mother, had this twinkle in her eye all the time. And she smelled really good. And it turns out it was gin. Who knew? I love the smell of gin. I never even knew what it was, and I loved it. It was on from get-go. And everything seemed to be going along just fine. I was raised with a belief in God. My father was a Protestant, not too into it. My mother was very Catholic, totally into it. Raised to believe in God first, husband second. Moved up to the Adirondacks, where we are strangers in a strange land. We do not share one of six last names, which apparently is a requirement. And I felt really out of place. And my mother was also out of place, pulled from the nest of seven brothers and sisters, away from her family, in a house built in 1863 on a back road. And I remember the first winter, we moved in December, there was a bobcat on the ledge. And in the spring, snakes would come out of the stone wall in the basement. And it was like, where are we, man? It was very hard for my mother. And my father started commuting to New York City for work. That's where his job was. He never left the job. So it became mother raising these six kids and dad, who was rarely there. And then the day of the day when he said he wanted a divorce, and then everything fell apart like a house of cards. And I was sixth grade at the time, and I was so mad at my father for breaking my mother's heart. You know, she was all in. And she was an alcoholic, but she started drinking alcoholically with a neighbor up the street. And I remember if we came home from school and my mom's car wasn't in the driveway, that meant mom was up the road. And it wasn't going to be a good night.
And when my father came home, they would drink too much and fight. And I remember thinking, and then my father would go away again, and then my mother would make promises to come after school and watch the soccer game, and she wouldn't be there. Or we'd come home after school, and she was still in bed and really smelly and very sad. She would stare in her mirror and drink warm Budweiser and cry, and I thought, I'm never going to be like that. That is so weak. I'm never going to be like that. And as 7th and 8th grade rolled around, luckily for me, I was one of only 23 people in my class. It was a very small school, and everybody knew our business. But the lucky thing was, you could get wine like that. The 18-year-olds are passing in the hallway, man. So I remember there was a New Year's Eve party, and I was 14 years old, and somebody said, we're having a party at so-and-so's house. What do you want to drink? And I said, whatever tastes like champagne. So 4 years later, you know, it's still there. And that began my drinking career. But I also liked being a good daughter. You know, I was very helpful to my mom as much as I could be. I liked behaving. I liked the reward of doing well. I liked having high honors in class. I liked the $50 gift certificate from having the highest English average in eighth grade. You know, I was elected. I was the captain of the JV cheerleaders. I couldn't even do a split, but it didn't matter because nobody could. There was only 23 people in my class, right? So I could excel at a very high level doing very well. But I was also doing these things on the weekends because now alcohol is taking an important and exhilarating part in my life. And I am hanging out with people that are older than me. And I'm avoiding going home because there's nothing there but sadness and drinking. So I'd make the lunches for the brothers and sisters, and I'd make sure we're all on the bus, and then I'd hit the streets. The you know, the damaging streets of the blinking traffic light at the four corners, you know, smoking. But I earned a reputation, and it's not the one I have in Alcoholics Anonymous today. You can measure my downward spiral by the nicknames I had. I was bossy. I was mouthy. I was, then where to go from there? Megaphone, because I was a cheerleader. And then tramp. And then it went downhill from there. But I was also valedictorian of my class. President Sin Castle. You know, I was just like Bill talks about. I felt so little of myself on the inside that I had to be everything on the outside so that I could be number one. It was so I could feel better about me. Because as I never had much self-esteem, and after Dad left and poor Mom climbed into a bottle of scotch, I was on my own. And I'm textbook, you know, no father, you know. She's from a broken home, you know. And I would say, I'm fine, you know. And I would pretend I didn't hear the whispers in the hallway. And I remember I had two wingmen, my older brother Jeffrey and my younger brother Matt. My brother Jeffrey went off to private school. He hated it. He wanted to be home with us. He knew things were bad, but my parents wouldn't let him come home. But he was always praying for me. And until I moved down here even, he sent me a book by Charles Stanley. I didn't even know Charles Stanley was from Atlanta. And it said, How to Listen to God. And I thought, I need the prequel. I need the one that says where to find him. Because I was raised with a faith in God. But as Mom and Dad and that life fell apart, and it didn't look anything like a God that would love me and care for me, God was no longer a certainty to me. God was maybe a wish, a hope. And then as I became more alcoholic, a threat, I came more and more pulled apart from God, and I didn't know what I was supposed to rely on. So I'm going to rely on myself very much. After 28 years of that, here I am. I drank alcoholically through high school. I was a blackout drinker. My best friend was a home ec teacher. Her mom was. She said, I can't hang out with you anymore because you have a reputation. Even though I was on honor society, for crying out loud. I had 3 out of 4 of the characteristics. I didn't have character, but I had the others. But I would have told you I did. And alcohol took me places that I never wanted to be. And when they talk about here in Alcoholics Anonymous that we drink against our will, I had to learn what will meant. I didn't know what it meant. It means what I want. And I became a bartender because after going to college and being magna cum laude in theater and English, that was purposeful. Might as well. First, I worked the third shift at a diner where the truckers called me their little tomato. Mom thought that was kind of a step down after all I'd done. And then I became a waitress, and I always had money. I always worked. I was cleaning houses when I was 11. I always knew that money was the answer. I knew I had to get out of that little town. I had a car paid for before I had a license. My best friend test drove it for me because it was a stick shift. And I was going to get the heck out of there because that was the problem. And I got all the way 25 miles away, worked for the Olympic Committee, and then became a bartender in this tourist town. And I took up residence and stayed there 10 years. And my decline went ATL, which I think is interesting because it's Atlanta, but we called it Around the Lake.
And I went from the big fancy club to the nice little cottage to Hell's Bar. That's where I earned the nickname Nightmare. That was another nickname I had. What would happen is I would drink too much and I would turn the corner. And I worked for a woman who also turned the corner. And when we went out drinking together, which wasn't often, we were nicknamed Nightmare and Cujo. So you can see what kind of a lovely pairing that was. And that was just the beginnings. And I moved to Atlanta because I think, the problem is this tourist town. And my sister and brother-in-law lived here, and they had a logical idea of what life is all about. And I moved to Atlanta, and I thought, I'm going to start over. Like we say, you know, we have a firm resolution not to drink again. And then suddenly we find ourselves drunk. I love that. Just struck drunk. And I love where it talks about this is the baffling feature of alcoholism as we know it. It's this utter inability to leave it alone, no matter how great the necessity or the wish. And I started having wish at 16, 17, when I knew I wasn't going to be the Marian kind. At 20 and 21, when I discovered townies. I went to a women's college to sort of get away from my social issues with men, and I discovered townies in foosball. So it just doesn't matter. You know, we can't shield ourselves. The book talks about any method to try to avoid alcoholism that is physical isn't going to work because it airs where it exists. People in meetings say, my disease is out there doing push-ups. Out in the parking lot doing push-ups. I wish it was that far away because maybe I could outrun it. It's right here. And that's what keeps me coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous. It's my stinking thinking. My thinking, the insanity of alcohol, as they talk about, is disproportionate thinking. Mountains are molehills, molehills are mountains. Obsessive thinking about what someone did wrong to me last year or 10 years ago. I'm not obsessing about the wrongs I did too much. There's some moments of remorse, but really it's more about all the wrongs you did to me. Rusty Jones always used to tell me, these people on your four-step, they're the people you're holding responsible for your contentment. And I thought, well, I'm not going to let that happen. By golly. So anyway, so I come down to Atlanta, and I think it's going to change everything, and instead I take up residence in a nice little dive bar, sorted places where I can reign supreme. And so I write checks to the bar. That's how reliable I was. I always made sure I had money because that was going to fuel my drinking, but I ended up here and in the same place, demoralized, I don't know how many times. It'd be okay if the learning about, you know, it says we learned we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. Too bad we don't learn it the first time. How many moments of incomprehensible demoralization can a person withstand? I think my drinking kept me from killing myself, really. But what happened was, I started developing these thoughts. Anytime something that I would regret I did, a thought would cross my mind about something I did yesterday or last year or when I was 15 with that guy in that car, muscle cars. I almost found God there. But I would think about how awful that was, and I couldn't wish it away. Just like I couldn't wish away the obsession to drink, these thoughts would come back again and again. And I started developing this flash where I'd be slitting my wrists or eating a gun. Now, that was new. I'd never been that depressed. I'd never been that hopeless. And they weren't things I was thinking up. I wasn't, like Bill, after his spiritual experience, he says, while I lay in the hospital, a great thought came. You can tell by the writing. The thought came to him because he had a spiritual experience and now his channel is open to God. It doesn't say, I had this great idea all myself. And that's what happens when we start connecting to a God that's greater than us that really does have my best interests at heart. But I had to go through Alcoholics Anonymous to find that out. And God had to come to me in the form of a really bossy woman. And I only was able to surrender to that when I had scared myself into Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd gotten used to the way I stunk. I'd gotten used to going home alone. I'd gotten used to trying to blame somebody else for the way I drank. What I wasn't used to and what I was deathly afraid of was the thoughts I was having that I might kill myself or somebody else. I knew I couldn't do that to my mother. She had eventually gotten sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, wanted all of us to go see a therapist. I'm like, I'm fine. I don't need a therapist. You know? And that's how I came into AA, too. You know, but I was also secretly wishing and hoping something would work. And I remember my bottom came in three parts. I remember I found myself very thirsty and losing weight, and my sister said, sounds like you have diabetes. And I said, she goes, you need to go to the doctor. And I said, can I wait till I hit my goal weight? I'm almost there. And she said, no, that's a dangerous thing to do. So I went to the doctor, and he told me, he gave me this prescription, and it had that martini glass on the bottle with the X on it. said, you have to take this stuff and you can't drink anymore. I'm like, whoa. And then I was thinking, gee, if I don't stop drinking, and this is honest, I was telling this the other night on my Zoom call. The first thought I had when they said, you can't drink alcohol because you're diabetic, I was thinking, I'm going to be on that awful bar stool 20 years from now with Coke bottle glasses because I'm almost blind from diabetic damage, and I've lost a limb to it. So now I've got a prosthetic, and I'm drunk, and I want someone to dance with me. And nobody will. And that, honest to God, was more of a true vision for my life than the fact that I might be able to get sober in this place called Alcoholics Anonymous and be redeemed. It was easier for me to think, I wasn't worried that my life was going to get worse. I was worried that it was never going to change at all. And then Monday morning, I'm starting over. And then Monday afternoon, it's like, hey, you're starting to come back. 4 o'clock, we can have a drink. We can have a couple drinks. No, we can't. We're alcoholic. And I'm like, when did I become a we? Now I'm all fragmented on the inside. I don't even know who I am anymore. And I'm not telling you because the best defense is an offense. So I'm fine, and you can just take care of your own mess. And as long as I had the job, which I just scared everybody. I was the boss, and my ruling method was intimidate. Just keep them at arm's length, especially so they can't smell you. But they told me I was firm but fair in my better moments. Firm but fair. But I was disciplined in that. So anyway, I ended up diabetic. I knew I had to stop drinking. Then I was promoted, because in the restaurant business, drinkers, we can get promoted. We just got to, show up, pretty much. And I did have some good qualities. I had leadership qualities. They were getting a little disintegrated, but I still had something going on. And I got promoted to director of training, where my job was to ascertain talent for the management program, which I wrote, and then evaluate them. And I was in Myrtle Beach, where we had 4 restaurants, and I got really drunk, and I was in a bar, which I didn't know was inhabited by all of the employees in the 4 restaurants we owned there. And I danced on the bar with one of the waiters. And I think I told, I told off one of the GMs, because why not? I know everything. And I had a hazy recollection of what happened. And on a Sunday morning, my boss called me and said, hey, we need to talk. Anytime today's good, I'm in Atlanta. I'm like, it's the same feeling I had when I saw that I can't drink anymore with diabetic medication. The dude lives in Myrtle Beach, and he's in Atlanta on a Sunday morning. So I walked up to him and met him at Joey D's, and he's like, we have something we have to talk about. And I was like, oh, God. And that's when he said, you got to cut this out. You're a professional. We have to be professional. You have to clean this up. And I said, you will never have to have this conversation with me again. And I knew as I said it, I knew I couldn't even trust myself to keep that promise, because I was out of control. But then what happened? Oh, Norman. I named my bottom Norman because this is too much. So I'm dating this guy. And I am known for my assessment of talent and character for my company. And I meet a guy in the bar where I meet all my guys. We've known each other 20 minutes, so it's time to plan the wedding. And so what I did was I invited everybody to my house to have a barbecue so they could meet Norman. And my mom was in town because she lived in Florida. And I invited my best friend, Tommy, who today is doing remastering songs for my brother. But anyway, he was there with his wife and his kids, people that really matter to me. And Norman was late. My mother, he called me, so I'm sorry, I'm running late, I'll be there soon. And my mother said, why is he late? I said, he's coloring his hair. And mom said, don't you think that's a little odd? And I said, no, in Atlanta, there's a lot of metrosexuals, they're very hip, And it turns out that I got really loaded after that party, and I went out with an old friend of mine, friend with benefits, those. And we took a limo to Lakewood, and we saw Paige and Plant, and we made a host of fair weather friends, and I did a bunch of outside issues and woke up with someone I didn't know. And I thought, oh, I've ruined everything with Norman. I woke up thinking I ruined my life. I had the best thing I ever had going for me with this guy, even though I outweighed him, and he was quite petite. But I really thought, this was the one. And so I talked to my friend Patty, who worked at the bar, and I said, oh my gosh, I've cheated on Norman, and I've got to find him. And she goes, Norman? I said, yes. She goes, Norman? And I said, yes. She goes, Norman's gay. Now, I don't object to that. It's not my business, but that was not my type, I said, he's gay. She goes, so it turns out he used me as a beard, thinking I'm a good, we are both so whacked out. He takes me to his sister's wedding. He thinks I'm classy. I am not. I am hammered, but I'm driving a nice car, But, so anyway, so I
I just thought I have to get sober. I don't know this yet about the gay part till about a week later, because now I'm obsessing about him. But I decided I've got to get sober to save this relationship, which turns out didn't exist. And that's how God works in my life. My God is a sense of humor, by golly. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous to save a relationship that wasn't even there. And I stayed long enough to figure it out. But I got very obsessed with that. Where'd he go? What happened to him? But that eventually faded away. And I came to meetings. And I was sitting on my hands hoping I'd find something. What am I waiting for? I knew. I'd been to AA before when I first became diabetic. 18 months later, I'm finally back in there. And I know that it's something about sponsorship and steps. I know that I really thought originally that's for people with no jobs and maybe only some of their dental work and things like that. But what I realized was it was really for people that were hopelessly alcoholic, who suffered this obsession, who when we honestly want to, we can't quit entirely. Or if when we start drinking, we have no control over the amount we take. That was me. And so I sat on my hands wishing and hoping. I wasn't sure what I was wishing and hoping for. And people talked a lot about love you till you can love yourself. And newcomers are most important in the room, person in the room, and some of it sounded like Charlie Brown's teacher, and I just didn't know. And then this one woman shared, and it was like zing, and I could hear her, and she was clear, and she talked about how she was alcoholic and hanging out in abandoned houses with people that she shouldn't have been mixing with, and even though she came from a good home, and she got to a place where she couldn't stand the thought of living or dying, and she asked somebody for help, and they took her through this book. She diagnosed herself, and she took these steps, and her life is different today. And when she spoke, she had a certainty, and she had a look in her eye that it didn't suck. And honestly, all I was looking for was less sucking. What you promised here was just too much. I just couldn't believe it. But I had to hope there was something a little bit better. And it coincided with my cousin, who was alcoholic, sending me a pamphlet saying, I got sober in AA. I have a year sober today. So I took a shot. After three times of hearing that woman, I finally went up to her and I said, will you be my temporary sponsor? And she said, do you want temporary sobriety? And I'm like, no, I don't think so. She goes, well, it says right here, vital to permanent recovery is strenuous work, one alcoholic with another. Don't you want permanent sobriety? Well, yes, I do. I didn't know. Please let me change my answer, because yes, she goes, how long did you ever have sober? I said, I don't know. I had about 90 days and I chose to drink again. She said, what makes you think you chose? I said, that's what they say in these meetings. That's why I said it, you know. She goes, says right here, we've lost the power of choice in drink. What makes you think you can choose whether you drink or not? And then I started thinking about those last few times I was driving into that crummy bar and crying my eyes out because it's a Sunday night and no self-respecting woman goes to a bar on a Sunday night because she can't go home. I thought, I need to change my answer. I was drinking when I didn't even want to. And so she said, here's what I want you to do. And she said, this is what you know about getting sober. And I'm like, yeah, I liked her 5 minutes ago, you know? And then she said, I want you to start to diagnose yourself as to what this book says, because you have to decide if you're alcoholic. And this book will tell you if you are or you aren't. She goes, people say you have a drinking problem. You think you might have a drinking problem. You have to know. This is for you to identify yourself as alcoholic. So why don't you start reading and highlight your experience, and we'll meet once a week and read the book together, and we'll figure out, you know. And, man, some of those lines, I had arrived. When I had that Olympic job in Lake Placid, man, I had arrived. It was only a 9-month job, but I had an expense account and a truck, and I was hanging out with Chuck Mangione and people that had the best outside issues ever. Anyway, So I knew what that felt like. I also knew what I felt lonely again and turned to alcohol. I also identified with, nevertheless, I still thought I could control the situation. And then the frightful day comes. And then the part where it says I could wish for the end. You know, I suffered all that. So as I started to read it, I started to get a little bit excited about the inventory, which is weird. So one for me was a decision. Only took 28 years for that one. Two, the decision to trust the power greater than myself happened when I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous. That's my first foray. That's the first action I took to show that I was willing to believe. I needed to believe. I believed at one point, and maybe. And then I did follow the direction of a sponsor who I've learned is a person who puts my hand in the hand of God. But if I can't follow a few simple directions from someone with skin on them, how am I going to follow this power that I haven't connected to yet? So she was the placeholder.
And she didn't explain any of this, by the way. You know, some of my new responsees, they get kind of the nicer, gentler version of mayor, which ain't much, but it's better than it was. And I'll tell them, you're doing this. You're doing these disciplines. You're following me. You're going to call me at a certain time, so I'm making that time for you. And you're going to commit to calling. Why? So your kids will believe you when you tell them you're going to show up. You know, this is all practicing for life. You know, I'm not doing it because I'm a control freak. I'm doing it to see, are you ready to surrender to something greater than you? Are you ready? You know, this book says, follow the dictates of a higher power, and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world. Dictates! Now, the plain language big book, which I'm a fan of, because it helps get the message out to people that have a lower educational level and want to see something a little less antiquated. And in there it says, follow the guidance of. The guidance of. That's nice. It might be, depending on how, what kind of sponsor you have, you might have a guidance, you might have guidance. All right? Well, I had guidance. And I didn't know that everybody didn't do it that way. We had a meeting one time. I wasn't allowed to share until I took the steps. And there was a women's meeting, and they were all complaining about their sponsors. And I was like, I can't even complain about my sponsor because I can't share in meetings yet. I wanted to stay after it, just, bitch. But I was getting results. She was getting me there early. She was showing me how I could look people in the eye and say hello instead of learning all their shoes. You know, she taught me how to think less of myself and more of them, even though none of it was comfortable. I was making coffee at my first home group. I signed up to make coffee until I realized, I don't know how to make coffee. I know how to do it at home, but I can't do it here. I remember feeling overwhelmed because I was going to have to make coffee for a meeting that broke into five groups, and I don't know the measurements. And I thought, I'm not going to be able to do it. So I went really early to that first old-timer came in and said, I'll walk you through it. You know. But you guys, I started showing up. And I started realizing I'm not thinking about drinking every minute. And I'm going with my sponsee sisters who do not like me because I've decided compliance is the way with this sponsor. No challenging, just say, okay, yes. Now my mind's saying, bitch. But my actions are doing something else. And little by little, I realize I'm on the path that really goes somewhere. It says in this book, our feet are set in the path that really goes somewhere. So the day comes, she says, come to my house, come early, it's going to be a long day, bring your lunch, I know you're diabetic, I don't want you passing out on me, and we did the third step and then launched into the fourth step, which caused me to do a lot of crying on her porch, and she was napping! My guts are all over, and she is napping! She mentions that my sponsor. But when that was all done, we did a fifth step. She shared some of her secrets with me. And the unburdening that I experienced from that, because I never had therapy, I was never going to tell anybody anything, and there was some stuff on there that I would have liked to take to my grave, but the relief in it was profound. I didn't even really feel it till the next day, because I went to bed like, I don't know what I just did over there. Pray, write it out, burn it, pray, talk more. Go to bed. And I woke up feeling like you're talking to me. I'm not sure about the wind on a mountain, but I felt like I was connected to something. And I remember going back to my first AA meeting, and I'm thinking, I got the secret handshake. I've done the inventory, and I'm walking hand in hand. And then she got me started on my ninth step. I had to do the first amends in the first week. So pick the easiest one. My mother said, Mom, I have to do my ninth step in AA. She goes, oh, no, can I just say all is forgiven? I said, no, I have to say it. And so I did all that, and I also learned how to do amends in the moment. A couple years into my sobriety, a friend of mine I'd made there had a couple years, and he learned he had cancer, and he was going to die, and it was going to be soon. And he said, I'm so grateful for the ninth step, because I could make everything right, and I'm good to go. And the minute he said it, I thought, Luann. I offended Luann through her parents. Luann says hi. Well, she never did. Like, whoa, you know. So I called Luann. I hadn't talked to her, and 15 years, and I said, Luann, I'm looking at my ninth step in AA. And she goes, oh, I know all about the ninth step. My husband's an Alcoholics Anonymous. And just like that, you know, we were back on track. It's just tremendous. The thing about God is, you know, it talks about we can accomplish a personal relationship. And in the inventory, what it talks about is, I love this part in We Agnostics. I can read it every day. It says, you know, we've been seeing a different kind of liberation, people who rose above their problems. We like to say, sure, tell ourselves it's not true, meaning people that have connected with God. And it says here, actually, we are fooling ourselves, for deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. We hunger for this. We don't know how to name it, but we hunger for this.
And it goes on to say, it may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things. Calamity, bad stuff that happens to me. It could be my dad dying. It could be my computer crashing. Anything on the spectrum, depending on the day. All right? All those things block me because I don't trust that God's going to take me through it. Pomp, ego acting out. I got this. Don't need God. I got this. Worship of other things. What am I giving my time to? I gave so much time to that big job I had because I was so afraid of losing it. And I have lost a lot since then, but nothing of value. Porsche that I really liked. Some really fancy furniture. But nothing of value. And nothing that could give my life any meaning. To be in relationships with the people that I love today, to have real women friends that came out tonight, to have a character that people rely on, and not wake up wishing I was dead. So it says, we finally saw that faith in some kind of God was a part of our makeup, just as much as a feeling we have for a friend. Sometimes we had to search fearlessly, but he was there. He was much a fact as we were. See, a God had become a suspicion, a wish, a threat. When I did this inventory, it established God as fact for me. I don't know how that happened, but I came out of that knowing there is God. Period. Because I made the decision, God's either everything or else he's nothing. And I want everything. I am not the Bailey's on the rocks type. I want everything I can get. And it says here, we found the great reality deep down within us. We have to dig for it. It's spiritual surgery. He's buried under all the garbage of my life that snuffed out the light. And then it says, in the last analysis, it is only there that he may be found. It was some of the, it's the last place I look. And it's an analysis. Who knew that making columns and putting down stuff about my feelings and my mistakes was going to be such a spiritual thing? But it was the beginning of that journey, the relationship with God. And what that did was it uncovered the God. And then it reminds me, and it says, this is one of my favorite promises, if you can think honestly and search diligently, the consciousness of your belief is sure to come to you. Sure. Fact. Promise. So I did it as thoroughly as I could, and it surprised me. And my sponsor said, if you want to hang on to that, better start doing a 10-step tonight. And she showed me how it's a written nightly review so that I can learn to recognize how to do it in the moment. So on page 84, it talks about what we do in the moment when these things crop up, these things that came out of my inventory. We share them at once with someone. We ask God to remove them. That's a prayer on my knees. And then we turn my thoughts resolutely to someone I can help. Now, I'm not good at practicing that as a newly recovered alcoholic because I just barrel through my feelings. Little uncomfortable, barrel through. Do the best you can. Try not to offend too many people. But now it causes me to sit and think and pause and analyze so that I can change. Because I want to change. But it is a discipline. And it is, I'm fighting it a lot. You know, I fight it a lot. But the more I do it, the more connected I become. And when I was told by a fifth grader friend of mine that God, she had a personal relationship with God, I was like, that's nonsense. Until I started getting some of those thoughts that were, I know they were not of me. They were just not of me. 2.5 years sober, I'm walking through my kitchen. Well, what do you think of me? I'm like, what? It wasn't a voice, it was a thought. It was a great thought. And what God was asking me was, you talk about God in the meetings, you don't say higher power, you call me God, but what am I to you? And it took me back to page 47. Don't let any prejudice you have about spiritual terms deter you from honestly asking yourself, what do they mean to you? And there were some things from childhood I still believed. So I started to search in that vein. And the more I did it, the more things opened up for me. People were coming to me about those things. And my world got bigger. And I started to matter to people. And they started to matter to me. I wasn't set out to, hey, I hope I care about more people soon. But that's what happened as a result of the actions you taught me to take. You taught me to have courage. You taught me to do it afraid. Fear ran my life. You taught me how to make things right. 10th step, that became a nightly thing. 11th step started out with, so I want you to pray on your knees morning and night and ask God for help. And I'm like, pray on my knees? I did that in church. But I'm like, first of all, I've been so separate. I'm like, oh, it's going to be so awkward. So awkward. But so was flashing the bandit whiskers. So white. And there were more people watching that than me praying on my knees. So why don't I just pray on my knees? And it's amazing because that one act has become so humbling because I've got a big, fat ego. And I was angry at things in my life, and I didn't want to trust anything that I couldn't see, feel, or touch until I began to see and feel. But it's in the pursuit. Step two says we have to earnestly seek. It doesn't say we have to earnestly believe or we have to earnestly figure it out. We just have to seek. And I remember the effort I went to looking for the drug dealer on Friday night. And now it's a pleasure to seek. I love the mystery. I'm glad I can't figure out God, because that's infinite. And I love the mystery. The stuff that happens, you know, and it's funny because when I get up here, I can never really think of those things. There was a time when I had to tell my story. Eileen drove me up and she had to leave the night I was telling my story. And it was right after I'd lost someone I met in AA. He became really important to me. And it was the first relationship I had where I really cared more about what they wanted for their lives than what I wanted for their lives. And then died suddenly 4 years later. Only 50 years old. Because he had a little boy that he'd lost custody of. He was living in Arizona with his mother. One of his favorite songs was Freebird. Now there's two camps for Freebird. You'll love it or you hate it. And I love it. So did he. And there was a certain pink of a shirt he used to wear, and his eyes were ice blue. So every now and then, the sky has those two colors in it. My best friend says, that's the Jeff sky. And every now and then, I see it. And this night, when I had to tell my story, and I was going to be all alone, this dark bird slowly flew across this Jeff sky as I walked up to that conference room and spoke. And it was just, I'm not saying that bird was God, but that was God winking at me. And I have a lot of those God winks. So many, I can't even. Making amends means to change something by adding or deleting. And I had to add more kindness and compassion. And that wasn't easy for me because I was so hardened. And I had to delete some of the less desirable behaviors. A lot of the amends I've made are around my family. My oldest brother, Jeffrey, that was one of my wingmen, died during COVID. But not of COVID. He died of despair. He was so done with heartbreak and depression and the side effects of Crohn's disease that he just said, I'm not going to eat anymore. I'm not doing this anymore. And because it was COVID, nobody knew where he was, really. His oldest daughter was only 18, living her life. And by the time we found him in a rehab center in Virginia, he was 818 pounds. And he had signed a... The nurse said, I've never seen a case of a person so depressed in my life. And he always was kind of a blues guy. And he probably had undiagnosed manic depression. But he's cut from the same fabric, and I knew if I'm not careful, and if I don't follow these principles, and if I don't keep looking for God and feel connected, I can die of despair here. I've got a friend who hasn't had a drink in 2.5 years. Despairing. Won't leave the house. Not going to AA anymore. Not treating this. Alcohol treats this at a low level. But this hunger is deep. And it's only fueled by one thing. God and the effects of being in relationship with God. And our assignment is to stay close to him and do his work well. My brother Matthew, my other wingman, he also died during COVID. My baby brother died years before that. So I'm like, I'm done. I have 4 brothers, 3 are dead. And Matthew was, he and I lived solitary lives all of our lives. He got married to a woman who was kind of reclusive and kind of odd. And they had 3 strange children. And he was like a foreigner in a strange land. And he was the most generous spirit I know. He was also did everything behind the scenes. I want credit for everything, you know. But he was a quiet, good soul. He was a respected man of the community. He couldn't do enough for anybody. He used to fight for my dishonor in the locker room. He was a blues songwriter. He had 2 guitar stores in Saratoga. When he died, we closed the business. We knew it wasn't going to be the same without him. The entire city of Saratoga put lanterns in all their windows and declared February 20th Matt McCabe Day, and they did an online service for him. There were 484 people on it. One guy said there's 55,000 people in Saratoga and probably 70,000 stories about Matt McCabe. I don't like his kids. But I love my brother. And I decided I'm going to stay in touch with them and do as much as I can as an aunt, because he always appreciated that I made the effort to be with his family. And it was fighting tooth and nail to finally get his ashes scattered in an Adirondack lake this summer. And his oldest son is a real piece of work. But I'm going to go up and watch his fiancée sing in a choir in June. And I'm going to honor his memory by doing that. And those are acts of forgiveness that I'm not going to be able to forgive until I do it. You know, it says in the book, with a man we dislike, we take the bit in our teeth. Gunner, Jeff's son, was 8 when Jeff died. He's 23 now. And we began a friendship when he was 8. I'd go visit him in Colorado at Grandma's, and I put him on a snowboard, and now he shreds it, and I just go to the lodge. He couldn't do his homework very well in his senior year. Sophomore and junior year, he got a little off track, a little too much weed. And he called me one night, and he said, I need a call time. Now, all my sponsees have a call time. And Gunner's been here enough. He's been to meetings with me. He always, when he comes to visit, who's the craziest one you got now? Yeah, he always wants to know. But he called me one night and said, I think I need a call time. He said, I quit smoking weed, but I'm very anxious. I have a hard time just doing it day to day. And it's a 3-hour difference. So his call time was 10:30 at night in Atlanta. He was out for a run at 7:30, and we would talk turn him on to the Stoics. And that's the same thing we do here. They're the same kind of principles, courage, integrity. And now he's in school, in college. He went and served in Iraq for 3 years. Said it was a blast. Who does that? Right? He was part of a special detail because he had strong marksmanship, and he was a special detail of the leadership. When they left the base, he was part of their contingent. And he got to wear Izod and carry a pistol, and he was living it, loving it. And then he came back, and he's at Prescott University, and he's studying international security and defense, and he's got an internship this summer at Grumman, Northrop Grumman. Now, I never had enough dignity or character to have a family. But he's the gifted black paper for me. He said, you know, we used to kind of like be friends. He called me rectum when he was 11. It's a long story, but anyway. We used to kid around a lot. He goes, but now you're more like my aunt. And I said, do you mean you respect me? He said, yeah, that's it. He gives me a reason to sort of stay straight and do it right. And he loves me, and he counts on me. And his mother likes me. She's like, take him for a week, please. The things that Alcoholics Anonymous gave me are things that I really can't measure in dollars. The ability to forgive, even when I don't want to, is a real gift because I don't have to live in the angst. And I'm free. I'm free of the bondage of self. And my sponsees that I sponsor teach me more about me. You know, I've got to have enough humility to see where they're right. And I always want to have one that's next. And hopefully, when they come up to me and they say, they want a temporary sponsor, I'm going to ask them if they want temporary sobriety. And thus, the journey will repeat. Thank you very much for having me tonight.
Thank you very much for your story.
First I slip, and then I quit. A hope-filled dream. You rescue me, and finally, waking there I see. I look into love's window for a soul. Take me where the promise.